somebody sent me a package, and it was the membership list of Skull and Bones. I'd never heard of Skull and Bones before. And I let the package sit for maybe 2 years. This happened about 1980. The package arrived. I let it sit because it had no interest to me. And then one day I probably had nothing better to do, so I started thumbing through the list, and I thought, well, my goodness, this is the establishment. Name after name after name, you know, Bush, Bundy, Mallon, Harriman, all these names were coming out at me.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Israel declares war on Lebanon, Iraq and Syria, but they don't actually declare war, although they're bombing them. Where will it stop? Is it a provocation against Iran inevitable? Also, tomorrow, showdown in Hong Kong, journalists getting on planes to go and report on it. But will there be an enormous demonstration tomorrow, or will it just be a mass of arrests? And Epstein, who was he working for, Israel or China? Surprising new information tonight. We hear about the mysterious Humpty Dumpty Institute the Epstein family were involved with, congressmen and three Chinese nationals on the board, which nobody wants to talk about. Our New York City correspondent Kenyon Gibson, though, does. Plus, a new series on superbrains, those the mainstream media refuse to acknowledge and try to bury. Tonight, education and foundation funding of it in the 20th century, and how it's massively affected what we know and our mass media. We hear from Norman Dodd. And postponed from last week, mental illness at Hinckley C power station on the construction site. Could that be? Because the project they're working on is never going to be built. Before nuclear engineer and consultant John Large died last year, he was convinced that Hinckley C was way beyond any real possibility of being built. But like the Emperor's new clothes, no one wants to say it. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, local lad Ed King has been teaching over in Kazakhstan and China. As more and more young people take off across the world to find work, he explains the rigours of China's six-day teaching week, which starts at 7:15 and ends at 10 p.m. every day. David Saunders has been part of Extinction Rebellion here in Bristol almost since the start. He explains how the group that's now threatening to close Heathrow Airport for a week of drone attacks, how they do their business. And he looks at the thinking behind the so-called Third Industrial Revolution. Quite a lot to take in there. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday to that, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start, Martin, with the Israelis bombing various countries, Lebanon, Iraq. When will it stop, and why haven't they actually declared war on these countries?
Well, Netanyahu has said that he's done these attacks. Normally, what they do when they do these attacks, they refuse to comment on what they've done. In this occasion, Netanyahu has commented, he said, yes, we've done all of this, because it's an election in Israel, and it's part of what's going, the explanation of what's happening is it's Netanyahu's election campaign. But there's some very interesting details about the attacks that people perhaps don't realise. One of the drone attacks was launched...
Start off, just make it really clear. So we're talking here about Lebanon, Syria and Iraq have all been bombed. And are they airstrikes? Are they drone attacks by the Israelis?
Yeah, there's drone strikes, basically. Apart from it, I think in Syria they used aircraft.
And is it clear who's controlling these drones? Is it clear whether they're drones or aircraft?
All right, but let me just say tell people what's happened so we can discuss it. What I was reading is that the drone attack on the militia in Iraq was actually carried out from the area of Syria, which is controlled by the pro-Kurdish forces. People's Defense Forces, whatever they're called, and therefore that shows that they're in alliance with the Israelis. And the Iraqi government, which is in alliance with the Iranians, have banned, they blame the Americans for the attacks. They see the Americans and the Israelis as in cahoots, and they must be, because the attack came from the YPG are aligned. They've got some US Marines aligned with them, and they've stopped all US aircraft from flying inside Iraq. So the Iraqi government is about to break with the Americans because they think that the Americans and the Israelis are attacking them. The attack on Syria, well, that's ongoing. I mean, the Israelis have been supporting jihadists, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS, close up to the Golan Heights, but they've been cleared out now. And they've been basically supporting the jihadists all along.
Well, the Israelis may not be declaring war, but that's not the way that the Lebanese see it.
No, Michel Aoun and Hariri and Nasrallah have all said that we're going to strike back.
A pair of kamikaze drone attacks on Beirut's southern suburbs on Sunday, and a drone... worth mentioning, all this happened just last weekend. And a drone strike on Palestinian militia in the Bekaa Valley early on Monday morning were akin to a declaration of war. Lebanese President
Aoun
told the UN Special Coordinator on Monday, adding that the aggression allows us to resort to our right to defending our sovereignty. That's what the Lebanese are saying.
Well, that's what the Lebanese are saying. It's interesting that Hariri, Aoun and Nasrallah are all on the same page here, but Nasrallah's gone one further. He said, no, we're going to strike back. You've just killed two of our people.
Can you
Lebanon.
Just tell us the difference between these different factions? I mean, Lebanon has always been a bit like
The Lebanese constitution, because you've got a very, very multi-ethnic makeup of the situation, and the end of the civil war. I mean, the president of the republic has to be a Sunni, and that's Hariri. The leader of the parliament, I think, has to be... No, the president is Aoun, that's right, and the prime minister has to be a Sunni, and that's Hariri, and the speaker of the house, which is Nabi Berri, has to be a Shia. But anyway, they're all major players in Lebanese politics, and I think Hariri lining up with Aoun and Nasrallah is interesting, okay, because they're the two different sides
worth mentioning of the
battle historically in Lebanon.
Worth mentioning the target, it's the media centre, Hezbollah's media centre in Beirut. So they're not going for actual soldiers or people who are doing anything wrong. They're going for their ability to communicate with the rest of the world.
Well, they killed two people. I don't know what their roles were, but there's definitely two dead bodies.
So obviously, surely Hezbollah has a right to communicate with the rest of the world. That's what the Israelis
They're now classified by the British government. The British government has recently said this, that they are a terrorist organisation, therefore outlaws, and therefore anybody can kill them anytime they want, even though they're actually part of the Lebanese government. And of course, they're going to strike back inside Israel. They're probably going to kill a couple of Israeli soldiers. That's what they're going to do.
In Syria, Israeli missiles attacked several targets outside Damascus over the weekend, killing two in what the IDF claimed was a preemptive strike against a large-scale attack of multiple killer drones on Israel by Iran. Ironically, a larger version of what they themselves were preparing to inflict on Lebanon. So we're now in the arena of preemptive strikes. So we're saying, you haven't actually done anything, but we think you're going to do this, so we're going to bomb you.
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole situation, not just in that last weekend, is moving rapidly towards a confrontation. And as you all know, as anybody knows, the best form of defence is attack. And if you keep provoking people, ultimately they will take you up.
What was the justification in your mind by the Israelis for this? It's okay for them to just bomb other countries?
Well, I mean,
they don't need to go through the UN, for example.
They're basically trying to establish that they can do whatever they like and nobody can tell them. That they don't play by any kind of rules. It's a sort of mad dog theory. You know, what's it Mushy Diane said? Everyone is regarded as a rabid dog, and therefore not to mess with us. And that plays well to a rather deluded Israeli public. But of course, if there is a major war, lots of Israeli civilians, lots of Iranian civilians are going to die. Lots of Syrian civilians are already dead. But the people who go shopping with their credit cards in Israel and drive cars and go on foreign holidays, their children are going to be burned to death as well, if they really want to go there. And that's not me saying that. That's what war is all about.
What about apparent splits between the Saudis and the UAE as well over the Yemen war?
Yeah.
This apparently now... what's happening more and more is the domestic Yemeni forces, the Houthis, they so-called rebels, but actually they represent most of the people in the country. And well, President Hadi was imposed by the West on them. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the causes of the civil war going back, you know, 4 years or so. They're now starting to strike Saudi targets, including those in Riyadh. So they're getting the capability to actually hit back into Saudi Arabia. Can you just give us the context of this war? Because for a long time, actually Yemen and Saudi Arabia were part of the same country. This is going back to around the First World War.
Well, they were all part of the Ottoman Empire. And the Saudi government regime, whatever you want to call it, was created by the British to control the oil supplies. Because all the oil happened to be, you know, so they made sure that they got control of the oil supplies by supporting the House of Saud. Yemen is a much more populous, was always a more populated part of the Arabian Peninsula. And, you know, historically there used to be a Jewish kingdom down there back in the hundreds of years ago, but those people then converted to Islam. And, of course, the other thing that's happened this week, which most people won't be picking up on, is that southern separatists, because don't forget, South Yemen used to be a Marxist-Leninist state, the only one in the Middle East. They were absorbed into greater Yemen when North and South Yemen were amalgamated. But the southerners want to break away from the north. They don't want to fight with the Houthis. They just want to have their own country in the south of the country. And they are fighting now with the Al-Haddad forces. So the UAE and the Saudi Arabians are backing different factions there. And, of course, the suffering of the ordinary people is appalling. And, you know, all the aid agencies are saying this is probably the worst place in the world. And, of course, British military personnel, two people from the Special Boat Squadron, were wounded carrying out some kind of ambush to help the Saudi forces inside Yemen. And we're talking about, have the Israelis declared war when they attack all these countries? Have we declared war? What are the Special Boat Squadron doing there, helping the Saudis to kill Yemenis?
Martin, how are the two conflicts related? Are they related? This Yemen, well, they call it a civil war. Of course, it's not. It's an enormous intervention.
It's an invasion by an outside
country. It's an intervention from outside, yeah. And the Israel. Because what seems to be happening with Israel is they've slowly but surely got to the point where they now feel they can bomb most of their surrounding countries, certainly Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, with impunity now.
Well, that's right. I mean, all of these conflicts are interrelated. And the danger is that all these individual forest fires just get, you know, you start to get a firestorm, like when the British bombed Dresden. And so the wind starts to bring all these small fires into one great big huge fire. And, of course, this is the sort of thing that we really ought to be discussing, rather than gazing at our own navels here in the United Kingdom. But, of course, we're involved. We supply most of the weaponry the Saudis are using, and our military personnel are actually on the ground helping the Saudis kill people. Now, somebody in Yemen might decide that they're going to come back here and spoil our fun. And who could argue that they would be morally wrong to do so?
What I'm trying to get to is, you know, to what extent is this what the Saudis are up to coordinated with Israel?
Very, very much so. Very.
Because
much
I mean,
so.
You know, that we're looking at a Jewish state and an Arab state, completely different. Actually,
the only democracy in the Middle East and the worst autocracy on earth are on the same side about most things. The person who went to talk to the YPG about whether the Israelis could use their territory to carry out an attack on Iraq was a Saudi prince. And he was talking on behalf of the Israelis. He persuaded the YPG to allow the Israelis to come into their area so that they could use their drones to attack people in Iraq, because they couldn't get to them from Israel. It's too far away. And the Iraqis have immediately picked up on that and grounded all US air force, air helicopters, everything inside Iraq. And, of course, they're moving forward in Parliament in Iraq now to say we want all US forces out of our country because you're in line with the Israelis and we're just about to go to war with Israel and Iran's about to go to war with you and we're on the Iran side, I'm afraid, because we're Shia Muslims. That's the majority here.
So where's this going to end? I mean, we've been talking about this for years, but it does seem as if, you know, certainly that last weekend with the Israelis bombing these three countries, they've almost taken over. Trump has said, we're actually removing our military from most of the engagements in the Middle East, even though, of course, there's quite a lot still there, particularly special forces. But the Israelis are now, it seems, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems the Israelis are taking over where the US has left off.
Well, I know that the Lebanese are preparing for an Israeli invasion. They're expecting it. and they're going to strike back. They're much better prepared. They beat the Israelis in 2006. They're better prepared now. Hezbollah's taken loads and loads and loads of casualties in Syria, tens of thousands of people, but they've become incredibly battle-hardened. They're probably one of the best outfits on the planet, and I'm afraid the conscript soldiers of Israel are going to pay a price.
When it comes to Israel, we don't hear very much on the domestic BBC or any of our programmes, actually, about the way they treat child Palestinian prisoners. But Megan Owen on the BBC World Service did what I thought was an excellent and fascinating report into Palestinian child prisoners this week.
Now, we're going to talk about events in Israel. And a couple of months ago, the Supreme Court in the country turned down a petition to allow detained Palestinian children in Israeli prisons the right to call their parents. Once again, put a spotlight on the juvenile military court system in Israel, the only one of its kind in the world. Now, critics say it breaches several international human rights laws. How does it work? Megan Moen reports from the West Bank.
The journey to the jail begins at 5:45 a.m. for Nabil. His 16-year-old son Mahmoud has been detained for stone throwing. The family get to visit Mahmoud once a month. The jail is less than an hour away, but due to Israeli checkpoints, the journey can take up to 6 hours.
You're going to see the trouble we go through.
The checkpoints. Issues with the checkpoints. Searching. Come forward. Go backward. Go there. And the machine beeps. It's a mess. It's exhausting. It's torture. As if we're also detained.
Every year, more than 500 Palestinian children, some as young as 12, are arrested by Israeli forces in communities in the West Bank. The most common charge is stone throwing. Israel is the only country in the world where children are prosecuted through a dedicated juvenile military court system. Saha Francis, a lawyer for Adamir, an organisation that advocates for Palestinian prisoners in the West Bank, says the issue is both moral and legal.
You raid a house after midnight in order to arrest a 14-year-old boy. It's not just against the boy himself. It's against the whole family. Imagine the father and the mother that they cannot protect their son. I wouldn't believe it's about security. It's about control. It's about control and maintaining the oppression against the whole society, especially children.
Israel says the charges can be more serious than stone throwing. Malak Al-Galbraith was arrested at a checkpoint at the age of 14 for an alleged knife attack on Israeli soldiers. She says she was made to sign a confession in Hebrew, a language she doesn't understand.
Then they took me to a military camp in Jerusalem. There they interrogated me. She was yelling at me. She wanted me to sign a paper in Hebrew. She was asking me very strange questions, and I said, no, I haven't done anything. She forced me to sign the paper.
As the Israeli military's chief prosecutor, Morris Hirsch prepared indictments against thousands of Palestinians, including hundreds of children.
I often hear the claim that Palestinian minors are interrogated and forced to sign a confession in Hebrew. Great claim. But it's simply not true. And I saw the evidence.
That's never happened.
I came into the prosecution probably in 2003. Most of the statements of the Palestinian minors are written in Arabic.
Most of it, but they set up to...
One second. Those that are written in Hebrew, no child was prosecuted based on a statement written in Hebrew.
At a checkpoint that Nabil has to cross to see his son Mahmoud in prison, we're stopped for an hour and a half while soldiers question us as to why we're travelling with Palestinian families to a jail without prior notification. Worried that press may attract undue attention, we leave Nabil to continue his journey to see his son for the 45 minutes they have together this month.
Megan Moen, reporting from the West Bank.
Well, I mean, that's just one aspect of the oppression of the Palestinian people. There's thousands of political prisoners who haven't been charged with anything. The Israeli state just takes it's got the right to imprison anybody they want.
Well, they're terrorists, though.
Well, that's it. According to the Israelis, all Palestinians are terrorists, but that's not true. And in any case, the Israeli state was created by terrorists, so they should those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, eh?
But, Martin, I mean, let's try and take this a little bit more of a serious level. Even children can be terrorists, can't they?
Yes, but of course, in actual fact, as one of the mothers said, it's not really a security issue. If somebody throws stones at you, if they've stopped throwing stones at you, they're no longer a threat. You don't put them in prison indefinitely, especially if they're under the age of 16. But of course, what they're doing is they're harassing the Palestinians. And ultimately, of course, if there's a major war, they're going to try and ethnically cleanse them out of the West Bank. And they're going to try and they're actually talking in the election campaign now of annexing the whole of the West Bank.
This is not a sort of juvenile court. This is a military tribunal for children. Palestinian children as young as 12, according to the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, are taken from their homes at gunpoint at nighttime raids by soldiers, blindfolded, bound and shackled, interrogated without a lawyer or relative present and with no audiovisual recording, put into solitary confinement and forced to sign confessions, often in Hebrew.
Well,
a language which they don't speak.
That's right, and some of them are just shot dead out of hand. What's going on in Gaza? They've got snipers shooting people dead, just for nothing. And this basically is a pretense at legality. It's basically warfare. And ultimately, of course, in warfare, force decides.
Okay, so let's move on to have a look at Hong Kong now, because tomorrow there's an enormous showdown, apparently, maybe. Even though the demonstration has officially been called off, many believe that thousands of people will come out onto the streets and face arrest, because the demonstrations, which have been going on for several months now, have been banned. Lots of journalists climbing onto planes, although there are quite a few over there already, and they'll be watching very closely what happens there tomorrow, Martin.
Well, obviously I've got no inside information about what the actual situation on
what about the background to what's going on. What
got?
About the background to what's going on in Hong Kong? I mean, I was making a few jibes earlier about Hinckley C relying on Chinese money and possibly not happening if things don't go well between British and Chinese relations in Hong Kong.
Well, that's right. I mean, and don't forget that Britain has agreed that they will allow Huawei to operate in this country, but the Americans are totally against it. And, you know, if we come to doing trade deals, one of the first things they're going to do is say you
can't
do deals
with China. It's quite obviously an enormous popular movement. It's not just been stirred up by MI6, has it?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that it's probably both. There's genuine grievances, and there's lots of people who are genuinely worried about being controlled by the Chinese communists sent over the border. And there's also the West has got its vested interest in making things difficult for the Chinese. So both things are probably operating.
If
the Israeli army were there and they saw people throwing petrol bombs, what do you think they would do? What do you think the Israeli army would do?
The Hong Kong police have arrested activists Joshua Wong and others, including one of the MPs. Actually, much of this is to do with a demonstration back in June, but they're really trying to send a very clear signal that these demonstrations have got to stop and that none of the demands will be met.
Well, I mean, the demonstrators, you know, they've got their demands, which I would characterise their demands as what Trotsky used to call transitional demands. They're demands that they know the Chinese are not going to give, and therefore they're basically pushing for a revolutionary situation, which I think is unwise of them, frankly.
Well, what would you do if you were them? I mean, well, surely they don't want to be extradited into China,
well, I mean,
do they?
They've already succeeded in stopping the extradition law. That's been shelved for the time being.
Well, it hasn't been.
No, it's still there to potentially be brought forward.
It's been postponed potentially
but
it hasn't been shelved.
No, I know.
So that's one of their demands.
I'm aware of that, Tony. I'm just trying to say to you that a situation like this, Solidarność in Poland in the 1980s, when I was involved in Polish Solidarity Campaign, I was involved peripherally in some of the discussions about tactics, and they put forward the demand, what they called a self-limiting revolution at the Solidarność Congress in 1980, where they said, we don't want to overthrow the government. We don't want to change the government of Poland. What we want is the right to form free trade unions. And they definitely stopped. They didn't demand full democracy or that Poland should leave the Warsaw Pact. Now, in actual fact, that was quite wise because it meant that the Russians didn't have an excuse to intervene.
Is it okay to arrest Andy Chan, who's campaigning for independence in Hong Kong, just to actually want something is a crime?
The problem for the authorities...
Wanting independence is a crime,
the problem for the authorities is this. If you arrest him, then you make his cause that much more believable and, you know, it's the same with these Israelis. You're locking all these people up and you're making the point that there's no talking to be had with you.
So do you think the Hong Kong police will bottle it, or will they arrest a million people if they turn out tomorrow on the streets?
Well, I think what will happen is this will... If I was on the Chinese side, I'd just shrug my shoulders and say, well, they're just going to have to be allowed to demonstrate. They can demonstrate as much as they like. They're not going to change the government in Beijing, and they're not going to change the government in Beijing's policies by demonstrating in Hong Kong. And the Chinese government should just relax and let them demonstrate, because they can't. But they're not going to achieve anything.
And why aren't the Chinese doing that then?
Well, they are to some extent. They could have gone straight in there.
Well, 900 people have been arrested, including three MPs. Yeah, but that's,
the Hong Kong police are dealing with some demonstrators who have been blocking an airport. What would you think would happen if you and I sat down in Heathrow and blocked it for 5 days?
They weren't actually blocking the airport, Martin. They were protesting in the airport. Well, the planes couldn't fly. They were protesting in the airport so that any people coming in and out of the country could see them, but they were not blocking the airport.
As I understood, lots of planes didn't fly.
Well, so that many planes were cancelled. Was by the airport.
Well, in any case,
the whole point of the demonstration was to do a peaceful demonstration inside the airport. Wouldn't stop people using the airport, but would make it very clear.
Yeah, but it's quite clear that some demonstrators, obviously not the majority, probably a small minority, are engaged in things which would be illegal in any country.
Interestingly, we could just quickly swerve to Heathrow, couldn't we? Because in 10 days' time or so, Extinction Rebellion are planning to shut down Heathrow for 10 days using drones. What do you make of that?
Well, I think I don't actually approve of that. I think it's a silly idea. But there you go.
Why?
Why? Because if you want people to listen to you and you've got a cause to push, disrupting their personal lives to that extent...
But isn't that what trade unions have been doing for hundreds of years?
No, trade unions have to operate within a very, very...
But they disrupt people's lives, don't they?
Yes, they do, but they've got to do... If you go on strike, there are rules about going on strike.
If you close down the railways or something.
Yes, of course, but if you use drones to close down an airport, that's not a strike, is it? And it could... I mean, the IRA nearly killed me when I was flying back from Yugoslavia in the 1990s. I just got into the terminal and they dropped a bomb onto the runway that I'd been on a few moments before. I heard it go off. And they were actually in a hotel right next to the runway and they just dropped a mortar onto the runway. Now, that is a tactic.
Extinction Rebellion are not planning to do that.
No, I'm just saying, but if you're not prepared to go that far, perhaps you ought to just stick to the basics and just protest in a normal way. If you're not prepared to go that far, you're not serious, are you?
The argument is, really, that these drones are potentially extremely dangerous when it comes to aircraft.
I mean, if anybody gets killed as a result of that,
if they get ingested,
are they going to be happy with that?
If they get ingested into an engine, that can actually cause a plane to crash and hundreds of people to be killed.
Yeah.
So I don't know if Extinction Rebellion really thought this through.
Well, the IRA, I don't think the IRA were trying to hit a plane, they were just trying to disrupt the airport. But if you by accident crash a plane with a load of people on, do you think that's going to make people take climate change more seriously?
Well, what they're saying is if we start flying drones around, actually they will stop at Heathrow, they'll stop.
Well, I mean, the anarchist idea of direct action behind what they're doing, I understand. But you've got to recognise that if you carry out direct action, which basically makes ordinary people lose their lives or be very seriously inconvenienced or injured, you're unlikely to get your cause regarded as a serious one. You're actually undermining your own position. And I would ask them to think very carefully about what they think they're doing there.
In fact, they have thought very carefully about it, because the people from Extinction Rebellion who are doing this are actually sort of trying to form a separate group. In fact, it's called Heathrow Pause, so that if planes do crash, that they won't be associated, hopefully, with Extinction Rebellion. So this is a sort of normal tactic, I suppose, Martin. The authorities are threatening that these people, if they do this, could go down for very long prison sentences.
Well, if you're going to have non-violent protests of that kind, you've got to be prepared to take the prison sentences that go with your illegal action.
Well, it is potentially violent if a plane crashes, isn't it?
Yeah.
Never mind non-violent.
Well, exactly. So if you're not prepared to go the whole hog and drop a mortar bomb on them, perhaps you'd better just stick to chaining yourself to the railings.
I mean, do you think actually using drones is actually more akin to a kind of armed struggle than a non-violent direct action?
This is the problem, isn't it? Where's the line to be drawn? Yeah.
Whereabouts, going back to Hong Kong, whereabouts do you think that is going to end up, that one? Because China is starting to increasingly point the finger at the UK, saying, we think you're encouraging this, and this is going to damage UK relations.
Well, I think that's pretty obvious that it's that we are encouraging it, and it is going to damage relations. I would suggest to the Chinese, do not send the Chinese army into Hong Kong, because that will crash the world economy, for starters.
The Chinese army is already in Hong Kong. No, there are about 6,000 or 7,000
soldiers
in Hong Kong. Yes, I know,
but they're in their bases. They're allowed to be there because Hong Kong's part of China, but they shouldn't deploy them against the demonstrators. Leave it to the police, and the demonstrators will demonstrate as long as they want to demonstrate, and the police have just got to put up with it and deal with it in a responsible fashion. Okay. That's the only way to deal with it.
How do you think it's going to affect Hinckley C? I mean, this is just another... Yes, it's a related story, but this is Chinese money which is being depended on for building a power station down the road here, just the other side of Bridgewater.
On EDF, aren't they, and the EDF technology.
Well, that's France, which we're not... No, luckily, we're not having this international dispute with the French at the moment.
No, I know, but I mean, the point is... The thing is that the whole world economy is teetering on the brink here, and it's quite possible there's going to be a massive crash in China as a result of the internal contradictions that they've got.
Okay,
and
so...
if that happens, then... And of course, if there's a war, shooting war between the West and China, the Chinese army will go straight into Hong Kong and there'll be a bloodbath.
Well, the first major problem in the Chinese funding for Hinckley C... was when a Chinese delegation 2 or 3 years ago were left in a tent in the rain with no one to speak to them, and the people they were supposed to be talking to from the Hinckley C project didn't turn up. So that wasn't a very good start. But do you think the Chinese money will ever appear for this power station?
Well, the Chinese have got a problem, which is they've developed nuclear power inside China, and they've got quite a lot of functioning power stations, but it's like being a heroin addict. If you the French are the same, that's why EDF are involved. Because nuclear power is not really viable if you factor in the waste products, which you've got to keep looking after thousands of years. And ultimately, the only way you can make it viable is by selling it on to other people.
So some people are saying that Hinckley C is not financially viable. They're saying that
most nuclear power is not financially viable. That's why the British government has subsidised the building of it, because if it was done by the private sector, they just say it's not worth the bother.
So what was it then? Why did people sign these contracts? Was it a contract fraud?
Now, what you've got is the idea that we've got to have certain amounts of megajoules of electricity and what have you, so that we can do, you know, it's old think. Yeah, we could do a lot better by actually becoming much more energy efficient. But instead of being energy efficient, we build a nuclear power station because that seems to be a nice simple solution. But of course, the private sector wouldn't build it on its own without subsidy. They've been guaranteed a price higher than the actual price of electricity for a number of years, which is basically the British taxpayer underwriting the building of a power station. Now, I'm a socialist. I'm prepared to subsidise things if we want some. But I'd subsidise organic farming, for example. But why are we subsidising nuclear power station? It's quite possible, as John Large has suggested, that the actual technology that they're using, the EDF technology that they're using, doesn't work. In France itself, these power stations are often non-functional.
Okay, so, I mean, in a way, the reason we're talking about this is because of John Large. I spoke to his wife last week, and he died a little over a year ago. But I had a long conversation with him before he died about Hinckley C. He was absolutely 110% convinced that it was never going to be built for all sorts of reasons. One of those was because of, as you quite rightly pointed out, Martin, EDF, which is the main contractor to build it, is in serious trouble. Over in France, the latest we've heard from June this year is that they face enormous cost overruns and delays of up to 3 years at Flamanville. Now, this is the nuclear reactor which is building in northern France. The French regulator has ordered repairs. Not to go too much into this story, but EDF said, oh, well, there are a few problems with some joints in this reactor, but we think we can fix them after we start it up. And the regulator, French regulator, quite rightly in my view, said no, you fix the leaks before you start the reactor up, not after it.
Well, there's an interesting fact. In the 1970s there was a big drought in France, and they're using pressurized water reactors, so they need water to keep them cool. And because there was a drought and the water table fell, they had to switch them all off, because all this super technology depends on the rain. Unbelievable, isn't it? But true.
So this is EDF, and they are have also all sorts of other problems with their other normal reactors, which are operating. They have also been, some of those anyway, have been closed down by the French regulators, who seem much tougher than ours. And this is another problem, Martin, is that no one is entirely sure what regulatory regime is going to be in charge of Hinkley C. Is it going to be the EU regulators, or is it going to be the UK regulators? Some are even saying, because so much Chinese involvement, that it's the Chinese regulators that will be regulations that will be in place Somerset.
The other question I would say is, what's going to happen to the spent fuel? Because that won't be dealt with at Hinkley, will it? That'll have to go somewhere else. That'll probably have to go to Sellafield. And that's the real problem with nuclear power, is what do you do with the spent fuel? And if you factor in that you've got to look after that spent fuel for thousands of years, it just doesn't make, it's just not viable. The only reason we built nuclear power reactors were originally designed to make plutonium for bombs. And when the Indians built their nuclear bomb in the 1990s, they basically bought a CANDU, a Canadian reactor, which was an electricity generating reactor, and they built their bomb on the back of the stuff that they made with that. And nuclear power as a peaceful enterprise is simply a spin-off from the production of nuclear weapons. We said, if we're going to produce nuclear weapons, we might have some nuclear power as well. But I would argue we don't need nuclear weapons, we don't need nuclear power, we need a revolution in much smarter and much more decentralized technologies.
And to use less energy. Do you think it'll happen, Hinkley C? Actually, all the talk is about mental health of the workers, and I can kind of understand that, where nobody seems to want to admit that this thing is a dead duck.
Well, I don't know whether that's directly related to the mental health issue, but it's quite possibly a dead duck. Because, as you say, Flamanville is still not functioning, and that's already been built.
Well, the thing is, under the existing regulations, they can't start Hinkley C, even if it was built, which it isn't, until the Flamanville reactor has been operating for, now I'm just remembering from my conversation with John Large, a year successfully before they could switch on the Hinkley C reactor. Now, understandably, that's another reason why they don't want to build the actual reactor itself at Hinkley, is because what if the reactor at Flamanville doesn't work? Because it's the first of this new type, identical to Hinkley C. And if the reactor in France doesn't work, which is, again, it's been put off for another 2 years, yep, as we've just heard from Reuters in June, we're looking at 4 years down the line before the reactor even gets approved, as if it works in France. So maybe this is another reason. Well, they don't want to spend any more money in Hinkley if it might never be allowed to be switched on.
The problem is with these things, you're in for a penny and you're in for a pound, aren't you? I would argue we shouldn't be in for a penny or a pound.
It's actually very similar, isn't it?
And of course, Fukushima is still leaking radiation into the Pacific. Massive amounts of it.
Isn't it a little bit similar to HS2? Enormous contract. HS2, we're talking about £111 billion, though, Martin. Mm-hmm. And many people are saying that this is just simply never going to happen. Although many people have sold their houses as a result, that because of the non-viability of this, that no one is actually going to spend that amount of money on it. The enormous cost overruns, of course, what they do is they'll tempt governments into signing contracts. And they'll say, I'm very, very sorry, but it's crept up from $20 billion up to $111 billion.
Well, I mean, Hinkley C, is already, if you look at the official figures, it's got to be subsidised. But, of course, the official figures are nonsense. It's going to be more and way more expensive than they've said. But, of course, once you've started on something like that, if you stop, then you've wasted all the money you've spent on it. But at some point, you have to cut your losses.
And what happens
if there is a major crash, is that all of these building projects, what will happen? Well, as soon as a crash kicks in, it may happen before the end of the year, all building grinds to a halt immediately because you can't sell the stuff that you're building.
All construction
workers are laid off. They're laid off straight away.
Back in March this year, the National, a Scottish paper, published, has no one noticed the UK national debt has topped $2 trillion now?
No, it doesn't matter because we've got magic money trees. Because of Brexit, we can cut taxes for the wealthiest, and we've got more police officers, and we're going to have more money spent on schools, and the deficit's going to get bigger because, hey, it doesn't matter. We've got a magic money tree. That's what the Tories are saying now, though that's not what they were saying 10 minutes ago. But isn't it just shows what a load of rubbish these people talk, doesn't it? We've been listening to that seriously for 10 years. We've been listening seriously about how there isn't any money. And then it turns out that we can print anything we like. Like Trump in America, massive increase in the budget deficit. Massive increase. Because, of course, you can if you want.
So
you
my,
can do it.
My guess is that the three-year delay to Flamanville is going to mean at least 4 years before the Hinkley C is actually really built. And that means that it probably will never happen. That's if this type of reactor works. But I mean, the Germans have decided long ago, haven't they? We're not having any nuclear power. No. It's a waste of money.
Yeah, and that's because of the strength of the Green Party in German politics.
But it's also a question of looking at balance sheets, isn't
it? Yeah.
Just a simple, is, yeah. The sums don't add up. So why are we in a situation where there's still people pushing for nuclear power, even though it's so massively, massively expensive and it's impossible to deal with the waste?
Well, this is what Milton Friedman pointed out years ago. Once people have got an industry, once we've developed an industry which is basically non-viable, like nuclear power, it's not just a one-off loss. They then keep coming back and saying, well, we need some more money to do some more of this. And you've got a nuclear lobby. Now, in countries where they haven't got nuclear power, guess what? They haven't got a nuclear lobby lobbying for nuclear power. If you've got a nuclear industry, then they're there and they're lobbying for more nuclear industry because that's what industry does. And then countries where they haven't got it, that finishes. You know, there's no lobby for it anymore. And then, you know, you can talk about other things.
Okay, on talking about other things, on to Jeffrey Epstein fallout. All sorts of interesting things still going on, but the mainstream press not reporting so much. The main thing that the mass media are reporting on this is continuing to harass poor old Prince Andrew about it, Martin.
Well, poor old Prince Andrew has got a lot of splaining to do, hasn't he? And apparently his friends have been talking to the media saying what he thinks about it all, but it looks like it might even be him pretending to be his friends.
Prince Andrew says he did not suspect Epstein's behaviour.
Well, that Epstein had already been convicted at that stage, and he got a plea bargain because, of course, Epstein's being protected by powerful people because Epstein's probably an intelligence agent, or was. That's what this is all about. It's not the child sex aspect of it is what everybody's picking up on. But what he's doing, he's basically schmoozing the rich and powerful, compromising them, and then passing all of the videos and everything he's taken back to his handlers at Mossad and the CIA.
The BBC have quite conveniently done a sort of timeline of Prince Andrew's links to Jeffrey Epstein. And I'll put a link up to that on our show page. Prince Andrew's links to Jeffrey Epstein. February 1999. Duke of York said he first met Epstein, a wealthy hedge fund manager. That was the first time the pair were linked in press reports. And he flew with Epstein and in his private Gulfstream jet in 1999, according to a logbook seen by the Daily Mirror in 2015, to the private island Little St. James in the US Virgin Islands. The Mail also reported that the logbook showed he'd flown on the same location to meet the Duke's ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, although the couple had divorced in 1996. He seemed to have a way, didn't he, of making friends with the rich and powerful, Martin?
Well, that's if you read Whitney Webb's stuff on Mint Press, she talks about the whole history of the mob and the intelligence services basically providing sexual services of minors to senior politicians and business people for purposes of blackmail.
Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were amongst the star-studded guest list at a party hosted by the Queen in June 2000 at Windsor Castle. The Dance of the Decades event saw more than 600 guests. And there were four royal birthdays, including Prince Andrew's 40th marked there. That was the Queen's third child was pictured accompanying Ms. Maxwell, daughter of the late newspaper tycoon Robert Maxwell. There's also December 2000 up at Sandringham. And so very close links to the personal links to, you know, be able to sort of chit chat with the Duke of Edinburgh and the Queen. And then also in New York in 2010,
was Jimmy Savile there too? That doesn't mention that, does it?
It does seem as if it's very, very close anyway. So I guess the Prince Andrew is going to have quite a lot of explaining to do. What do you make of his actual role then? You talk about intelligence services there. I mean, we're going to look at in a minute at at Kenyon Gibson's report, where he's actually saying, well, he doesn't think he was working for Mossad. He was working very closely with Israelis. He suspects it was more of a Chinese connection.
Well, I'll be interested to hear what Kenyon's got to say about that, because Ghislaine Maxwell and Robert Maxwell, the closest Jeffrey Epstein's closest friends, and Jeffrey Epstein is, of course, Jewish and very pro-Israeli. And I'll be interested to hear what he's got to say, because all the evidence points to me that he's a Mossad agent working closely with CIA and probably MI6.
Not to forget to congratulate and mention the Richie Allen from The Richie Allen Show. You'll find him on Twitter at Richie Allen Show, and he's got links to his websites there. He's an Irish, I suppose, internet radio journalist who I'm on his show probably once a month or something like that. I'll do a report for him, actually preempting some of the stuff we do on this program quite often, Martin. But he did predict, and let's have a listen to that again. We did this a few weeks ago, but I just the little bit where I was quite amazed that Richie Allen actually said on his program that he thinks that Jeffrey Epstein will hang himself, and he said this 2 weeks before it actually happened. Talk about being on the case. Well done, Richie.
Do you know what I think? I think he's going to walk, or something might happen to him. Now, I never make those types of... I never speculate like that. You know, I'm not one of those. I don't believe in being sensational, like yourself, Jason. But I think because you're looking at the royal family, you're looking at the Clintons, you're looking at Trump, you're looking at so many more people. Like you said, you made a brilliant point there. We don't have all the logs. He can't be allowed to talk, and I think he'll either walk and he'll go somewhere and we'll never see him again, or he'll have a fit of guilty conscience or something, and he'll hang himself or he'll slit his wrist. That's what I think.
Well, Epstein's defence lawyers are saying that they're not accepting that he committed suicide, and that the post-mortem suggested that he was actually strangled in the cell.
And there's also the fact that the CCTV, which was supposed to be permanently monitoring his cell, we only heard this because of the final closing of the court case against Epstein, where some of the survivors of Epstein were allowed to speak. Then we also came out in the final day of that court case, which is all now closed down, that the CCTV was somehow switched off or it was corrupted. Now, this is exactly what happened with Princess Diana. It happened on the 7/7 London bombings. One does wonder whether the CCTV is always going to be part of, if an assassination goes on, that those conducting that assassination will be making sure that the CCTV is somehow switched off or corrupted when they do that assassination.
That's right. Well, Epstein, I suspect, has been murdered. He's been murdered by the US state. And he's been murdered by the US state in order to protect lots and lots of people who would be compromised by Epstein going on trial. And Epstein, I think, worked with Ghislaine Maxwell, and she was definitely, I would suggest, a Mossad agent. And the Israelis spend an awful lot of money trying to blackmail
politicians. Hang on, you say was? You mean still is, or what?
Well, I think, but if you don't leave organisations like that, Tony. Yeah, Maxwell himself was probably assassinated by Mossad because he was getting them into trouble. And the problem with people who play in these kind of games is that you are expendable, ultimately.
And
of course you are.
So Kenyon Gibson is an acquaintance of both of ours. He is on this show probably once every couple of years, but he got in touch with me about the Epstein story and said, oh, well, I've been doing some digging over here. So here now is Kenyon Gibson. He's this show's New York City correspondent, and he himself was actually evicted by Mark Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein's brother. Kenyon had an art studio in Mark Epstein's building, and Mark Epstein turned up, apparently, very late one evening to evict Kenyon after he found out that Kenyon was doing investigations into child sexual abuse. Anyway, so here's Kenyon Gibson now talking a little bit about who he thinks Mark Epstein was, Jeffrey Epstein's brother.
I believe that he honestly doesn't know everything his brother was up to, but I do believe that Mark and Jeffrey were a lot closer than Mark wants to admit. I mean, you know, if Jeffrey's partner basically gives Mark Epstein a $50 million building, he's not the estranged brother, as the press is saying. And when the bail hearings came up in the first court cases in 2008, Jeffrey said, "I have no living relatives." Well, that was a lie.
So they're pretending that he doesn't know him.
In the original court case, was apparently Jeffrey Epstein said, "I don't have any living relatives." Well, this was just a flat lie, which could have been very easily disproved. Mark Epstein was his brother, was also around in New York, and owned various large buildings, was having various, you know, Are you suggesting
that Epstein was lying?
Failures of the police to do their basic stuff. But anyway, then I asked Kenyon about why he, because he's been digging into some of the various charities which the Epsteins were involved with. This one particular one called the Humpty Dumpty Institute, which involved Chinese nationals and also congresswomen. And Kenyon has been digging hard to find out what this Humpty Dumpty Institute was all about, and he's come to his own conclusions.
The wealth is coming through his brother's activities as a Chinese agent. And I don't think that Mark understands that his brother was a Chinese agent. That's what I think that I, you know, it's just the tone of voice, other things. But I think that Mark was very happy to be the bag man and get these $50 million properties.
But I mean, many people are pointing to the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service. What makes you think the Chinese are involved?
Well, first of all, Jeffrey is Jewish. So, you know, people kind of think, okay, Mossad. Jeffrey doesn't seem to have any trips to Israel, but then again, he knows people from Israel. So let's say there's a logical progression there. Here's what's illogical. Everybody, so many people, not everybody, but a good percentage of the people in Jeffrey's black book, Ehud Barak, Mortimer Zuckerman, who owned the New York Daily News, are Jewish. Mossad is going to spend a lot of money to spy on Jews. I mean, they could have showed up at the bar mitzvah. They didn't need to spy on themselves. I mean, it's like if you're Mossad, you want to spy on Arabs. Of course you do. You want to spy on neo Nazis. Of course you do. You want to spy on Mortimer Zuckerman? No, you don't need to spy on Mortimer Zuckerman. You can call the guy, invite him to Israel. You don't need to spy on Ehud Barak. He's one of your own.
So, is there any other evidence that links Epstein to China other than this?
Yes. Okay. Let's go back to the Humpty Dumpty Institute, founded in 1998 by Constance Milstein. On the board, there are three People's Republic of China citizens, or two of whom I believe are top executives at a gaming company. So this mysterious Humpty Dumpty that no one wants to talk about, that the congressional board members don't want to admit being members of, or don't want their staff to call me back and talk about. It has these Chinese board members. And again, going back to his days in Austria, something called the Golden State Bank. It was run by Kim Jong-il, who is Kim Jong-un's father. Now, North Korea is basically a satellite state of China. Now, at that time, Kim Jong-il was buying helicopters and weaponry for North Korea. The bank was investigated and closed by the Austrian authorities in 1982. And nobody stepped forward and said, well, what about Mark? Mark didn't want to step forward.
Is there any evidence as to what this Humpty Dumpty Institute is all about? Any evidence at all?
It has a website, and I've noticed that when we go to the website, and even one congressional aide confirmed this, it takes you to a sex pill site now. For some reason, it doesn't want to show itself, or it would appear that way. I Googled around and archived some of the stuff on the site. So I got the name. That's how I got the names of the 25 U.S. congressmen who are on the Congressional Advisory Board, most of them Democrats, including Barbara Lee, Sheila Jackson Lee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
So they're connected to China via the Humpty Dumpty Institute, but we've no idea what that institute was doing or pretending to do.
Well, I think it's pretending to assist children in the third world, and what I am afraid is that it may have been molesting children in the third world or sourcing children for child molesters. There's about a $3 billion child abuse film industry in the United States. People like Janice and Thomas Reedy were working in that. They had a rather large outfit based in Texas that got busted down years ago. And Edward Samuels here in New York City, who had 150,000 images of children on his computer, and he got a very sweetheart deal. The judge actually apologized to him for rough treatment at the hands of the police, and he is now out of jail.
Well, I think what he said earlier about he wouldn't want to spy on Jews, well, the Mossad would want to spy on the People's Republic of China, wouldn't it? So getting them compromised by having sex with children, they'd be perfectly within their the terms of reference.
And also, of course, there may be, you know, it's almost like our very own wonderful MI6 wanting to spy on people in the UK.
That's right.
They're not supposed to be allowed to do that, but what they can do is they can employ the CIA or a foreign intelligence agency to do that.
Well, you'd also you want to keep everybody on, even on people on your team, blackmailable. Everybody needs to be blackmailable. That's what Epstein's trying to make sure he's got something on everybody. Democrats, Republicans, Chinese, Israelis, everybody.
Okay, so that was Kenyon Gibson's report. Next week we will be looking at Charlie Holmes's report. I mean, he sent me a load of stuff on email about Ghislaine Maxwell. So let's have a good old look at her next week. She is acting sort of almost innocent, Martin, like butter wouldn't melt in her mouth, but she really should be in the dock, and possibly that case should not have been stopped this week, and she should be sitting there in the dock instead of Jeffrey.
Well, what's going to happen is there's going to be a massive cover-up of all of this, because the deep state is implicated in all of this child sex abuse, and ultimately, unless we, you know, a complete change in the political situation, they're going to carry on doing what they've been doing.
Time to sign off now for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Hot Wells and Harbourside, Mark Wright, and independent former Bristol Mayor George Ferguson. Download our MP3s, and you can listen in the car, the iPlayer, or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing an enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon, but do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.